we good? We good? Are we fine? Yeah. All right. Well, okay, wait, what? Wow. Damn. So the last podcast episode was in March 2022. That was around 2 years ago. And it's been, 2 years complete absence. Because, I mean, okay, let's just put this very bluntly. See, me being a student of the Indian education system, unfortunately, whoever is part of the higher secondary education in class 11 and 12 primarily has to face the brunt of not only academics but also school events, all of which tend to take up time, which is why the podcast was primarily not able to operate for so long. Nonetheless, now hoping that I have passed in my class 12 examinations, I think now we have enough time to make sure the podcast operates well, and plus it operates regularly, and it can finally report whatever has happened in the past 2 years. It's a lot of events, a lot of problems have come up, and I think we should take one issue at a time and go forward. I think, I think in 2021 and 2022, when we first started recording the podcast, we first found different issues affecting the world, all of which were creating geopolitical shifts and dynamic changes. Now, however, in 2023 and 2024 so far, there have been radical issues facing the world, and these are clearly shifting countries to very polar ends of the geopolitical spectrum. Now, obviously, a good part of this and the way conflict right now, which is taking place as we speak in a massive scale, is the Israel-Palestine conflict. And at the end of it, I think whatever is happening in this conflict is a very big point, is a power play issue. The geopolitical balance of power, etc., etc. Obviously, we will explain this later, but I think the important part is understanding this from the very roots. Obviously, let's make this very clear. At the end of it, no podcast, no website, nothing can do justice to this issue as a whole. This issue is vast, it's wide, it's very intensely disputed, and nothing can do justice to something like this. And at the end of it, remember one thing. There are actual civilian casualties on the ground. There are people who are not able to access humanitarian, primarily because of the issues affecting this power play equation. And ultimately, you have leaders who are radicalizing the people and are making sure that there is more conflict and more war, and peace seems almost null and void at this point. Now, without any further delay, I think let's come to the very date itself, 7th October 2023. You have the Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the PIJ, the Popular Resistance Committees, or the PRCs, the PFLP, or the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, the DFLP, or the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, all right? These different militias, organizations, start to attack Israel through rocket attacks, the usual way in which they have carried out problems and attacks against Israel. Now, let's take these one by one. Let's understand them. Let's see how each organization has acted in the past. It'll give us some amount of context. The Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP. The PFLP has been a very ardent supporter of the Palestinian issue, like in the 1960s, 1760s and 80s also, actually. The PFLP was very active. It was part of the PLO, partly acting independently as well. And it was responsible for carrying out violent attacks against the state of Israel. It had even flown around 3 planes to Amman, hijacked them, and then blew them up in Amman. This was primarily to, quote-unquote, increase awareness about the Palestinian issue in the entire world. And let's speak about even the fact that the PFLP was apparently responsible for the assassination of some Israeli members of the Munich Olympics team. Now, obviously, this made the PFLP a massive targeted problem for sure. But I think more importantly is that the PFLP was also responsible for rejecting and thus opposing the Oslo Accord signed between the PLO and the US administration and Israel as well. I think we come to the Oslo cause later, but the PFLP primarily has played a very active role, but recently it has not really been that dominant, so to speak. Again, the same holds for the DFLP. The DFLP is a very extremist leftist version of the PFLP, and it has played a very, again, minute role, but it's not that big a role as Hamas, the PIJ. So let's come to the PIJ, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Now, the PIJ was primarily a very extremist organization formed by the Palestinians to go against the Israeli state, the destruction of Israel. They've rejected the Oslo Accords. The Al-Quds Brigade, which is the military wing of the PIJ, has been responsible for bombing and attacks against Israel. The PIJ, very interestingly though, is actually properly financed and armed by Iran. There are several evidences to claim the same, and obviously it does fit the power equation understanding, so to speak. And Their primary allies have been Hezbollah, primarily because Iranian proxies, Hezbollah, PIJ, etc., they've been able to work in concert in order to work against it of Israel. The primary thing is the PIJ has always been viewed favorably as well by majority of the people in Gaza. And I'll explain this shift as well, the very shift of the people of Gaza from the idea of, well, a peaceful resistance to violence, etc. as well. But the first thing first, the PIJ primarily, from what we understand, is a very extremist military organization, and the PIJ actually has played a very active role so far in whatever attacks have taken place against Israel in the past 24 years. Coming to the main party responsible for the offensive so far is Hamas. Now, the Hamas is a very radical group. Primarily, it does not have any direct influence of Iran. Very interestingly, it broke ties with Iran after the Syrian civil war for certain internal reasons that we'll discuss later, but not right now. And it has gotten support from Turkey as well as other states like North Korea, which apparently once had provided an arms deal to the Hamas and provided weapons. Then, moreover, Hamas has indeed called for recognition of the state of Israel on the 1967 borders and a two-state solution, but it carries out terrorist activities. So, I mean, at the end of it, the Hamas initially was very much in favor of the destruction of Israel. However, with time, Hamas has in fact changed its stance and it made it much more moderate in that sense. Now, obviously, what is after 7 October, that entire stance has changed drastically because you obviously have Hamas fighters now capturing Israeli hostages. You have them launching a full-on offensive against the IDF, Israel's army, basically. And the fact of the matter is, it's very clear at this point Hamas no longer believes in the idea of a state of Israel, primarily because of whatever has been happening in the past 4 years. Now, from what I also understand, Hamas in 2006 was also responsible for winning the Palestinian legislative elections. Now in 2006, there were elections held in the Gaza Strip, all right, between two important parties. One is the Fatah and one is the Hamas, all right. The Fatah played on a very important role of, yes, mediation with Israel, obviously looking out for Palestinian interests, etc., etc. And the Hamas, on the other hand, was very much in favor of destruction of Israel, and they primarily believed in the idea of a completely free Palestine without any compromise. Now, remember one thing, the Fatah is the current ruling party or government which represents the Palestinians in the Palestinian National Authority, the PNA, all right? And the PNA has primarily been responsible for representing the Palestinian cause in the UN, in other international organizations, etc., etc. I think so far, as we see it, Hamas itself can be regarded as an extremist radical wing of the Palestinian movement, so to speak. And as from what we can see in both the elections as well as in public polls, Hamas today polls the highest among Palestinians, both in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, primarily because, again, this is a very clear indication of what Israel's actions lead to, but we'll talk about it later. Again, I mean, at the end of the day, we're just trying to get the parties on once and for all. Primarily in 2006, there was a major dispute in the Gaza Strip regarding who represents the Palestinian government, all right? In the West Bank, it was clear it was Fatah. However, in the Gaza Strip, which is also regarded as part of the Palestinian state, you have two opposing parties, Hamas and Fatah. And the elections in 2006 ultimately resulted in Hamas winning the election by a landslide. And there was a massive civil war, and there were conflicts which ultimately resulted in Hamas winning. Then the Israeli state began attacks against Hamas. That's pretty much well known. What is perhaps very important to consider is that despite Hamas's wide popularity, it has still not been able to get recognition as a legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. For however, reports indicate so far that in Moscow, Russian representatives have been indeed mediating between both the PLO and the Hamas, and which ultimately is trying to create a new Palestinian government, from what I can understand. And primarily, the idea is to create a much more representative Palestinian government, which understands the needs of the Palestinian people while not being too aggressive as well. See, the main idea behind having a Palestinian National Authority dominated by the Fatah was that the Fatah was recently not in favor of destruction of Israel. It was primarily a sort of representation for the Palestinians, but it was a very Well, let's put it this way. It was a representation of the Palestinians on paper. It was never in reality. And the Fatah had no problem with that. They were pretty much on board with the Mahmoud Abbas, who was now leading the Fatah and the PNA, therefore, has spoken and condemned Israeli actions in the Palestinian against Palestine. But I mean, at the end of it, the PLO has not been able to achieve anything material at the UN so far. I mean, at the end of the day, they can do such only limited action to the UN, right? And at the end of the day, that's why the people of Palestine moved towards Hamas, because of Hamas's direct action, so to speak, against Israel. Now let's come to perhaps the main party involved in all this, the very state of Israel itself. Now, Israel has a very bit of a disputed history to it. Let's explain how. For this, we need to go back at least a thousands of years, right? To around 71 AD, all right? This is disputed history, by the way. Now, the idea is what various Jewish organizations and Jews themselves portray or say is that in AD 71, you have the Romans who basically oust the Jews out of what is their homeland, Palestine, and therefore the Jews get dispersed to other countries in the world. Fine. This is a disputed history, but this is the historical backing on which many Zionists or Israelis put forward the idea of the Jewish state. But now, let's come to context. Following these thousand years, the 1800s, 1900s, you have a massive amount of persecution of Jews everywhere, literally everywhere. Whichever country you step into, there is anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism means a form of opposition to the Jews and as well as suppression of Jews. Discrimination, basically. Discrimination on racial grounds, religious grounds, etc., etc. Now, primarily, the idea of the 1800s and 1900s is that in countries like the US, in Europe, France, the Soviet Union, and even in Germany to a certain extent, before Hitler, obviously, or this is before Hitler, completely, you have persecution towards the Jews, discrimination towards them, discriminatory policies towards them. Let's give the example of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was extremely paranoid about the Jews. I tell you, Soviet archives, they primarily talk about how Lenin and Stalin, an entire communist party leadership in the Soviet Union, they were under the impression because of the Russian Civil War that there is a Jewish plot to overthrow the people, or overthrow the communist state, and to establish a Western-backed communist state, Western-backed state instead of the communist state. And the main idea was that the Jews would replace the communists, which was frankly quite, laughable, because, I mean, the Jews not even have a significant number in the Communist Party or in the Soviet Union. Let's come to Italy. In Italy, Mussolini was regarded as a fascist and was actually someone who initially was allowing Jews to enter the Italian fascist party, and later he turned to anti-Semitism. So, I mean, well, some places things are ruled by ideology, some places it's ruled by whims and fancies. Even in the US, for example, the idea of the Jews were earlier very well disseminated, and they were also persecuted in the US as well. And then you have people like Oppenheimer and others who come out, and then the Americans accept Jews openly. And again, that entire policy changes because of the Jewish. Now, again, this is another theory. This is not something of fact. But then again, there was this idea that Jews had dominated the American arms industry as well as the American government in the form of lobbyist groups. Obviously, APAC is one of those lobbyist groups. Coming to the main point, the idea was that by the 1900s, you obviously have this level of persecution against the Jews throughout the world, right? And that very thing leads to 1897, the creation of what we call the World Zionist Organization. Now, what is Zionist, the word Zion? What is the difference between Judaism and Zionism? Now, Judaism, followed by all Jews, is a religious, social principle, right? And again, it's the same as other religions, in the same principles, same methods, same doctrines, etc., etc. Zionism is a political ideology. Zionism is primarily grounded in the idea that there is a Jewish national home in Palestine, and every single Jew has the right to return to that national homeland. Now, the persecution of Jews was taking place to a great extent, and they started to move towards Palestine because of that. All right, now, hundreds of Jews started to enter Palestine slowly and slowly. And the Arabs in Palestine by then, who had dominated the land, did not really mind. I mean, they did not really oppose it to that extent. Things, however, changed when the First World War came. usually what we find in the news media or what we find from other people is that there's this notion that Jewish immigration increased significantly after the Second World War because of Hitler's policies. Yes, I agree, it did. But it was not that which caused the Israel-Palestine conflict. The conflict in Israel and Palestine began a long, long time ago, during the First World War itself. Now, how is that? In the First World War, let's put it simply, you have Serbia, Russia, and France and Britain on one side, the US as well. And you have Germany, Austria-Hungary, and a couple of other states, Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, as the central powers, the main opponents, so to speak. Now the First World War begins, and I swear to God, the First World War is literally the beginning point of every single conflict on Earth. I mean, come on, if there was no First World War, we wouldn't have a Treaty of Versailles, no Second World War, no Hitler, no killing. I mean, man, you know what's most frustrating is that some people are so instrumental when they're supposed to be so insignificant, actually. Like, think of Gavrilo Princip, right? The guy who killed the Austrian Arctic and triggered the First World War. I mean, like, no, it's very frustrating. It's very frustrating how certain people can just change history with, but still, whatever. Okay, I'm diverging. But the main thing is, you had the First World War. Proper conflict between these powers, right? Let's come to the Middle East. In the Middle East, you have the British and the French. They are both against the Ottoman Empire by the Turks, all right? The Ottoman Empire primarily controlled territories throughout the Middle East. And the thing is, the Ottoman Empire was controlling the Arab territories as well, including Palestine. And the Arabs wanted to create their own state, Arab independence, etc. And the British thought, let's use this to our advantage. Because obviously, I mean, if you want to topple an enemy state, start an uprising or a revolution, it will ultimately happen. Now let's see what happens now. Is that a British High Commissioner, Henry McMahon, speaks to the leader Hussein, all right, who belongs to the Arab world, who is the leader of the Arab world, and it is he who ultimately says that yes, we'll allow an Arab resistance, we'll ensure there is a proper Arab revolution against the Ottoman Empire's rule. And the agreement basically is that the British will allow this revolution to take place, they'll help the British, and the British ultimately will accept Arab independence over these territories. The problem only is this. The leader, Hussein, he himself points out territories which should be given to the Arabs for independence. And those territories include Palestine. But the problem is there was no, like, confirmation, so to speak, and no sort of approval or ratification. And yes, we agree on these territories completely. These were amended over time because the letters and the correspondences between Henry McMahon and Hussein took place for around 10 letters. 10 letters were exchanged to discuss these issues. I think when you come to this idea, this entire idea of toppling the Ottoman Empire gives birth to what we call the Sykes-Picot Agreement. The Sykes-Picot Agreement signed between Great Britain and France with Russian mediation or supervision. The idea primarily is that Britain and France divide territories among themselves. Britain takes over Palestine and other territories, and they would all become League of Nations mandates. Now, okay, let's come to the League of Nations. The League of Nations was again an international organization, the UN only, formed after the First World War, primarily tasked with administering territories occupied from central powers, the main opponents, Germany, the Ottoman Empire, and Austria-Hungary. And the main idea was the League of Nations would ensure international peace and security, obviously it failed. The point basically being is that now you have Palestine, which is clearly disputed territory because the Arab leaders weren't exactly clear on it, neither were the British at the end of it. And ultimately, you have in 1917, this increasing wave of support for the Jewish cause, primarily because, remember one thing, the Jews played a very important role in Western economies, in Western arms industries, and they played a major role in policy making because of that. Thus, when the British found this influence to be strong and dominant, they had to get the support of the Jews. Therefore, you have Arthur Balfour making it very clear that they would support the idea of a Jewish national homeland in Palestine. Now, this very idea of, a Jewish state in Palestine ultimately results in obviously number of Jews coming into Palestine. This is now in the thousands. This is when the Arabs start to oppose it, because obviously when you have outsiders or people who have a different identity or a culture coming into your territory, your region, and they are starting to occupy a great amount of territory, so to speak, you start to question as to like, okay, wait one second, what is happening? Why are we having people from different cultures, from one single culture coming here? What about our culture? What about our identity? These are issues which matter to people for various reasons. And because of this, the Arabs too oppose Jewish immigration quite ardently at this point. Now see, the Balfour Declaration also had sort of provisions. So yes, we will also ensure that Arab civil, political, religious rights, those are respected at the same time, and we will try our best to limit Jewish immigration. Now, this was happening all in the midst of the time when Europe was engaging in a very important phase of geopolitics, the lead up to the Second World War. Now, we won't speak about a World War II, but the most important factor, Hitler's rule in Nazi Germany. In the Nazi Germany, Hitler comes to power, and Hitler's main policy is primarily into the final solution. The final solution being the destruction of all Jews. Primarily because, again, this is another theory portrayed, and this is what Hitler believed, that the Jews were taking away German jobs, the Jews were taking away German employment, they were taking over the German arms industry, they were trying to influence German politics, all of which resulted in immense anger against the Jews, and therefore their persecution. They were put into camps, called ghettos. They were even, there was widespread genocide. There were measures taken to control Jewish births. They were put into poison gas chambers. The entire record, the Holocaust, which was this genocide, is brutal in several ways. And this ultimately results, in this massive emigration of Jews from Germany to other parts of the West, and even mostly to Palestine, because there was this idea now built in the Jewish community that Palestine is indeed the Jewish national homeland. However, then you also have Arabs there. All of those Arabs themselves understand that they have their own cultural identity, which could not be simply stepped upon by the Jews. Now, therefore, you have in 936 onwards this massive, violent, armed opposition by the Arabs against the Jews, and this results in clashes, etc. And even the British, who were at the time who had decided they would be the ones ruling over Palestine, they would end up suppressing most of the Arab opposition. Now, the British ultimately form the Peel Commission, all right? And the Peel Commission believes that there is a need to partition the land into a Jewish and an Arab state, along with the basic national zone stretching from Jerusalem to Jaffa, which is under British mandatory authority. So you have the disputed territory under British authority, certain demarcated boundaries for the Jewish state, and certain demarcated boundaries for the Arab state. This is opposed by both sides equally. Then comes the Morrison-Greedy plan. The Morrison-Greedy plan, which was actually brought up by both British and American diplomats, proposed the idea of Jewish and Arab provinces who would exercise self-rule under British oversight, and Jerusalem and Negev, with these two again being very disputed territories, especially Jerusalem because of its religious significance, these two territories would be under direct British control. And the very problem with the idea is that this plan was actually proposed by one of President Truman's very own appointees, diplomats basically. And President Truman initially, indeed, I mean, he did approve of the Morrison plan, but then ultimately he gave in, primarily because of, well, Jewish lobbying is in the U.S. Congress. I mean, it's a pretty well-known fact. You have lobbyists used at the AIPAC and others, which still date continue to dictate U.S. policy. The reason, if you find on Instagram or social media, why U.S. Representatives are so actively defending the Israeli state is because, well, I mean, the Israeli state pays their bills at the end of the day. And that's how ultimately corruption in America is pretty much rampant, because lobbying groups in the U.S. Congress is a legal thing. Now, obviously, Truman rejects the Morrison plan, and this causes a big problem, because now Truman is stepping into what we call the Cold War between the US and the Soviet Union. And the idea now is there's a need to ensure that there is complete American control over the entire world as a means of anti-communism, so to speak. And obviously, you cannot have a complete Palestinian Arab state which would be more willing to go with the Soviet Union, because again, the Arabs would never go with the Americans, because the Arabs as a whole have seen Western imperialism, have seen Western colonization through the British and the French. They would not want another one with the Americans. This is what explains another power equation, the geopolitical equation, primarily being that the Cold War dynamics that first play out in the Middle East to Palestine and Israel. Now, Truman orders, or actually he don't orders, he pressurizes British Prime Minister Bevin, Ernest Bevin, to ensure that 100,000 Jews are immigrated into Palestine. Now, the British were very much aware that there were violent movements of the Arabs. There were very legitimate concerns on part of both the Arabs and the Jews regarding what was to be done with the state partition. And there was clear indication by the Arabs that they would not give up their culture, their identity, and the same from the Jews, which is why the British wanted to handle this as diplomatically as possible, which is why the Morrison Plan was introduced, and so on and so forth. But ultimately, because by the end of the First, Second World War, British were in such a bad state economically and militarily that they were losing colonies everywhere, with India, the Southeast Asia, South Asian countries, etc., etc. Therefore, you have the British Prime Minister deciding that, well, let's leave Palestine. There's no point going on with this, especially the Americans also pressurizing us. And this idea of the Palestinian state, or even the Jewish state, is given up to the UN to look into this main matter. British troops are withdrawn, which were there in the Palestinian territories and the Arab territories. And even the Americans were never willing to give troops for this cause, because, I mean, as much as the US might want to pressurize countries into accepting the terms, they were not willing to take the burden of cost. Iraq's an example. I mean, let's not discuss that. Yeah, but the thing is, at the end of it, you have, now let's think about 1946, all right? The UN has come to session. The Second World War is almost over. And 1948, the UN begins to talk about the Palestine issue, because now this holds the most geopolitical significance in the Middle East. Now, this doesn't have any active Cold War dynamics, because the Soviets weren't that involved in the Middle East at that time. But let's understand the Arab mentality before we begin. So the UN first passes a resolution, a General Assembly specifically. It passes a resolution basically dividing the entire area into Jewish and Arab states, all right? Now, in Jerusalem, the very city which is the heart of that very dispute is regarded as a corpus separatum. Now, what is a corpus separatum? It basically means a separate territory altogether, a separate entity altogether that will be under the UN administration, all right? So, you have the same kind of a mandate system, so to speak, UN peacekeeping forces in Jerusalem, and that would be completely under UN control, internationalized basically. And there we would have two states basically, Israel and Palestine. And the Americans had actually pushed this plan through, but the problem is this: the Arabs were never on board with this. None of the Arab countries, be it Egypt, Syria, Yemen, Lebanon, Iraq, they were never in favor of such a state. Neither were the Arabs in Palestine, nor were the Jews either, because all believed they had a particular right to land. The Arabs primarily were fearing the idea of American domination. Remember one thing: you have Arab states, all of which have faced Western domination from both the British and the French. You cannot expect them to go in line with the Americans, therefore, right? And remember one thing: the Sykes-Picot Agreement violated what Hussein was promised by Lord McMahon at the end of the day. And because of that, there was this massive dispute as to the territories, which is why today we have the Palestinian issue. The Palestinian issue began because there was no clarification on the British side as to what territory was acceptable to them as Arab independent and what was regarded under British rule. Therefore, now coming to the main point, this is what fuels a lot of the Arab opposition to the creation of Israel, and this sparks off a civil war in Palestine. Now, the Jews formed their own militia and extremist organization, the Haganah, which was responsible for conducting attacks against the Arabs, even against British authorities, primarily to put pressure on them. And even the Arab countries, like Syria, Egypt, etc., they provided military support to the to the Palestinians, who in turn were making their own organization and were fighting against the Jews. This creates a massive civil war situation, right? Now think about this. The civil war obviously is sparked because of the issues of religion, culture, identity. But think of it in a wider context, all right? You have the Arab countries of Iraq, Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, Lebanon, Yemen, etc., etc. We all aware about the Sunni-Shia divides, which take place in Islam in the Middle East as well. Now let's think of it from this perspective. If this was really an issue of religion, if the Middle East was that sensitive about religion as an issue, wouldn't you have wars between the Saudis and the Iranians? That was pretty common, even the Iraqis too. And at the end of the day, Iraq would never be a neutral state if there was actually an issue with religion between these countries. What united them was the idea of being independent Arab states, free of any dominance whatsoever, which was the prime threat when the Americans specifically backed the state of Israel. The Soviet Union had abstained from the vote. They weren't really concerned about the issue of Palestine in that point of time. And that is why when the first state of Israel was created, you have all the Arab countries, or not all, a majority of the Arab countries come together to fight against the state of Israel. Now, this results in the first Arab-Israeli war of 1948. Now, under this, Israel captures all territory, and therefore, they're now put under occupation of Israel. Whatever UN territories were given to Israel, it was taken by them. Fair enough. But what was given to the Palestinian Arabs, around 60% of that territory was taken away from them. So you have millions of Palestinian Arabs who were in no situation of war, who did not want to be involved in the first place. They were now under Israeli occupation. And Transjordan had taken up, or what is called Jordan today, took up the East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip was taken over by Egypt. Fair enough? I mean, it's pretty clear. See, we won't explain the Six-Day War and other Arab-Israeli war, because primarily, see, the other Arab-Israeli wars are pretty much a product of Cold War dynamics, as well as mostly Middle Eastern geopolitics, but not completely centered around the issue of Israel and Palestine. The first Arab-Israeli war is the very product of what we saw in Palestine, which is why I think it's important. The first Arab-Israeli war is pretty clear to everyone here. So around 700,000 Palestinian Arabs are under Israeli occupation, and now Israel is a far bigger state than what it was supposed to be, and the idea of a Palestinian state starts dwindling. But what happens now is the Arab states begin to launch multiple different offensives against Israel. Fair enough? Now I think now we've understood the very idea of the military problem. Let's fast forward all the way from 1948, and let's come down to 1993, the Oslo Accords. Now, see, during this entire period of time, you have the PFLP, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, Yasser Arafat, the leader of the PLO, all of them coming together, all of them responsible for attacks against the State of Israel. And there is therefore this hostility between the Israelis and Palestinians. And there was great pressure on both ends to keep on fighting, to keep on ensuring as much destruction as possible. And then in 1979, you very interestingly have the Iranian Revolution, where Ayatollah Khomeini comes to power, and that changes dynamics in the Middle East quite rapidly, because you have a very anti-US Ayatollah coming to power in Iran, and therefore Middle Eastern geopolitics shifts. Now in the Oslo Accords, in 1993, the main idea was that when the Israeli elections took place, the Labour Party won. And the Labour Party's Yitzhak Rabin, who was Prime Minister, and Shimon Peres, who was the Foreign Minister, they came to power. And ultimately, their main idea was negotiation with the Palestinians. Because see, at the end of the day, let's put it bluntly, any conflict between Israel and Palestine will end up harming their own interests. It's not in Israel's security interest to have conflict with the Palestinians, which is why what happened was there were extensive negotiations between the PLO and the Israeli government. Arafat had come to the table as well. And see, obviously, there were going to be disagreements, there were going to be issues, but ultimately, an agreement was hashed out in the form of the Oslo 1, the Oslo 2 Accords, both of which spoke about several different provisions. Now, the first being respecting UN resolutions about the withdrawal of IDF forces from the occupied territories in the Six-Day War, See, the Six Day War was a major conflict which gave Israel exactly a massive amount of territory throughout the Middle East, and it was a blow to all the Arab states. So the Six Day War is very, very dominant factor in the territories involved now. The idea basically now starts to withdraw from the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the Oslo Accords also make it very important for an immediate transfer of authority to the Palestinians in terms of education, health, welfare, taxation, tourism, etc. Now, obviously, some of the civil functions and primarily a five-year transition period for Palestinian rule, even provisions for Palestinian elections, all of these being critical elements for a Palestinian state, because ultimately for a Palestinian state to require a government, to require a working mechanism for healthcare, a working mechanism for education, etc., etc. There was going to be a Palestinian police force. Okay, now these provisions seem very... They seem unreal at this point of time, thinking about what's happening actually. But the point is, a Palestinian authority was supposed to be formed, an authority which would be probably dominated by the PLO depending upon the elections. And thus, there were different areas. Now, one area would be given to the Palestinians, complete administration. One would be under Palestinian administration, but would also ensure both security for the Israelis and the Palestinians both. And then one would be under Israeli administration security. So it was a pretty clear division of territories with a bit of mediation on both ends, so to speak. Now, obviously, this is a massive step. Because see, at the end of the day, when you talk about these provisions, these issues, they were able to solve some of the most critical elements of what is supposed to be a Palestinian government, right? And that created a status quo, which is very, the very setting stone for future negotiations. Now, this is where things go bad. Hamas and Hezbollah, these two militias started to get very active in the 80s and 90s. This is with the creation of the, with the Ayatollah coming to power in Iran and the Shah's expulsion. And therefore, you have the creation of the IRGC, or what is called the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, primarily responsible for creating proxies, militias, all of which are responsible for carrying out Iran's foreign policy aims throughout the Middle East. And remember one thing, any peace between Israel and Palestine immediately causes a loss for the Iranians, because then the Iranians don't have any drums to beat. At the end of the day, when it comes to Iranian government, the government of Iran has failed on various fronts, be it economics, be it on the health issue. Women's rights is a massive, massive problem in Iran, and it has been seen in the past 4 or 5 years. But most importantly, in the 80s and 90s, they were unable to handle the economy. And when you have things like these, what better than having a cause for the people of Iran, and the cause being the Palestinian cause, one which is felt for very deeply by the people of the Middle East. Therefore, and obviously then the anti-US sentiment was always there. This results in Hezbollah and Hamas conducting suicide bombings and attacks against the Israelis. And Hamas, one thing, Hamas was also a major, not that major, but was an emerging player in the Palestinian movement, so to speak. See, once the PLO and the Israeli government came to the table, Hamas, the PFLP, the very extremist parties, they needed to make a cause for, no, this is humiliation, this is a problem, this is not going to work, we can't allow any kind of negotiation with the Israelis, etc., etc. At the end of the day, these parties require dominance, not actual peace, not actual work. And the same thing applied for Israeli extremists, and Zionist extremists too, all of which claim that there is no negotiation of Palestinians as an Israeli state. This is not for the Palestinian Arabs. This ultimately results even in the assassination of Prime Minister Rabin. And Shimon Peres, when he came over as Prime Minister, there were several policies which he implemented which were all very problematic for the Palestinians, primarily because, again, the Hamas and the Hezbollah begin to attack Israel territory. And obviously, the Israelis aren't going to take lightly. This ultimately results in the Israeli people electing Benjamin Netanyahu as Prime Minister in 1996 and his party, the Likud Party. Because, see, Netanyahu from the very beginning was completely against the peace process. And there are various statements, leaked videos, transcripts, all of which talk about Netanyahu's very idea of there being no Palestinian state, the very idea of Palestinian state null and void, because State of Israel has the entire territory of Palestine. And Netanyahu's coming to power changes things drastically, because now you have a radical leader from the far right who comes to power. And this is in opposition to Hamas and the Hezbollah. And remember one more thing, 1996 is also a very important time for American foreign policy, because remember one thing, the Cold War had ended 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and the Soviet Union was disintegrated, and America was now busy on making its own imperialist ambitions more important. And then you have the Gulf War, the Iraqis were the mess. So you understand, this is a very important period of foreign policy, both for the US and for the Israelis. Now, let's speak about the way, and now obviously let's speak about the revolution of the various resistance movements, again, by the Palestinians against the Israelis, because see, at the end of it, the Palestinians couldn't just sit by the front line and just wait for the Israelis to capture them, right? They put up a fight, and this results in what we call the Intifada, or the revolution or uprising. Now, the Intifada had two phases. One was the phase which took place before the Oslo Accords. Another took place after the Oslo Accords abandoned. There were problems, conflicts, and then there were religious issues. When Israeli ministers began to visit sites of holy worship, which were holy to both Jews and the Palestinians, and ultimately caused clashes with the Israeli police. Now, the first Intifada was quite out of the blue. It had completely surprised the Palestinian leadership. The PLO was taken off guard. You had graffitis, barricading, throwing off bombs, Molotov cocktails. It was a revolution on a massive scale, but at the same time, they did not want any violent measures. Molotov cocktails are okay. I mean, no, I actually know that aren't. I mean, Molotov cocktails are very no. They're very, how do I put this? It's not diplomatic way. The Molotov cocktails were designed. Let's put it this way. They are like, one sec. I think let's first understand what it is. It's basically like this bottle which you light the thread inside and you throw and it explodes and it's fire. Yeah, fine. See, the main thing basically being the Molotov cocktail has been viewed in various places as the symbol of revolution, and people don't really, so to speak, associated with violence or violent activity. No, but yeah, the Molotov cocktails, they seem pretty violent. You know what? We leave this to the legal guys. Let's let them handle this stuff. But the main thing basically being is that these various tactics were used by the Palestinians against the Israelis. And ultimately, because of this, you have a massive crackdown. And then the Oslo Accords happen, but then the Oslo Accords fail because of the Hamas-Hezbollah attacks. And in the 2000s, you have these clashes because of religious issues between both the communities. This ultimately results in what we refer to as the Second Intifada. And the Second Intifada was very well coordinated because you had the Hamas, the PLO, all acting in concert to ensure there was this massive resistance towards the for the Palestinian cause. And the Israelis, and therefore, because of this Palestinian against gunfights, suicide bombings, attacks, and this was very violent. This was extremely violent. This, obviously, I mean, any random person will understand that there's a need to make peace after this, but well, the Israelis never understood this. See, again, now let's understand. I mean, obviously, you can't expect the Israelis to be mad or insane. They aren't that. At the end of the day, when it comes to the ideas of realism in international relations, realism believes that every state is a mature actor at the end of the day. Even if they're ruled by Kim Jong-un, they're still... Kim Jong. No, it's fine. Even if Kim Jong Un is in power, it's a mature and very mature and at least think strategically. Now let's think of this from Israel lenses. All right, the very idea of Israeli security or the creation of a Jewish state was built for the idea of security of the Jews from the rest of the perpetrators, the persecutors, or the people who were discriminated against them. Therefore, they wanted an Israeli state. Then you have the threat of Israel, which has faced around 4 Arab-Israeli wars, and at the same time has also faced attacks from the Hamas, the Hezbollah, condemnation of the Arab League from various other countries, all of which have made it sufficiently clear that they want to destroy the threat of Israel. Obviously, this is bound to create paranoia. I mean, come on. I mean, if the Soviets got paranoid with nothing at all, I mean, you can possibly imagine the Israelis being paranoid with so much with all of these attacks. Therefore, you ultimately have the idea of the far right or the Israeli government that there is a need to tackle this issue using violent means, and the violent means primarily being those which involve the involve the destruction of the Palestinian state, and from the state then the various extremist elements within the state, the Hamas, etc. Therefore, in 2006, when Hamas came to power in the legislative elections in the Gaza Strip, Israel began bombarding Gaza ruthlessly. So much so, they even implemented an entire blockade on the Gaza Strip. Now, apparently, this blockade had allowed essential items to enter, although this ultimately resulted in a food crisis and a humanitarian aid crisis. But this blockade was not effective at all, because arms trafficking, weapons deliveries were still taking place to Hamas via Iran and its proxies to a certain extent. And what you find is, therefore, this idea of a massive Palestinian resistance against the Israeli occupation. The UN's condemnations have no effect. The Americans don't say anything particularly, except for the Obama administration, which in the UN abstained from a resolution which called the settlements illegal. Now, we'll come to settlements later. But the main idea primarily is it because of this perceived threat of the Palestinians against the Palestinians, not just Hamas, not just Hezbollah, of the all the Palestinian people, so to speak, against the state of Israel, you have massive bombardment, carpet bombing. The idea of security in the far right and in the government of Israel, that in order to ensure peace, we need to destroy Palestine. Therefore, and thus, because that very reason, we have conflict spreading from one year to another as the Hamas gains more and more power. I think now what's important is that we first understand the most recent Hamas attack, which happened in 2021 because of a religious conflict, a spar which took place. And through that, let's understand how the Israeli government thinks and how the Israeli government reacts. And is this reaction proportionate? Is this right to self-defense that Israel asserts, is this right to self-defense actually exercised in terms of what international law clearly states? Right, so now that we've looked at the security dimension of the Arab world, I think it's important to focus on what's happening in terms of the security version in Israel. Although obviously we've touched on this to a certain extent, I think it's important that we understand it in a much more depth, so to speak. I think obviously the first idea in terms of a threat to Israel's security is Iran, primarily because of the Israeli government's constant understandings and constant declarations and statements regarding how it's dangerous to ensure Iran has a nuclear weapon, or even regarding the fact that how Iran has destabilized the entire region, quote unquote. Netanyahu himself has come to the UN on several occasions speaking about the dangers of an Iranian nuclear weapon. And he was himself quite vehemently against the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Now, obviously, these factors are there. And at the end of the day, there is no denial of the fact that after 1979, after the Shah was overthrown and there was the Ayatollah who came to power in Iran, there was this increased understanding that there was a requirement to oppose the Israeli state because it was viewed as an oppressive state by people in Iran and by the government of Iran. And it has been the policy of the Iranian government to therefore condemn Israeli action, condemn Israeli aggression, and in doing so, it has created proxies, militias, very small organizations spread across the Middle East, starting from Hezbollah to Hamas, the PIJ, and the entire IRGC, which is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is responsible for carrying out these attacks against the Israeli government and the Israeli state. Now, however, though, when you think about the Israeli security dimension in the Arab world as a whole, not just Iran, but also Saudi Arabia, etc., the argument would have been valid till the Yom Kippur War, 1973, when till 1973, you had immense Arab, so to speak, anger against the Israeli state because of its annexation of territories, its refusal to give up territory to the Arab world, which had taken from the previous wars. And the Arab-Israeli wars had, in fact, had this massive impact on the Israeli state security. However, still, this argument can't hold, primarily because right shortly after Yom Kippur War, you had the Egyptian government coming to the table, talking to the Israelis, and signing the Camp David Accord, which primarily resulted in Egypt recognizing Israel as a state. There are prisoner exchanges plus other provisions which ensure a greater cooperation between Israel and Egypt. The other parts to the Arab world obviously were still antagonistic and continue to be to a certain extent, because see, partly there's been Syria, there's been Iran, there's been the PLO, all of which to a certain extent have indeed been very anti-Israel in terms of policy from then till now. And ever since 2020, things have changed. Let me tell you how. The Trump administration in 2020 and the successive years after have implemented a policy or an agreement called the Abraham Accords. Primarily, the Abraham Accords' main objective is to ensure normalization of the Arab states with the Israeli government. Now, this was a very desperate, or so to speak, a very decisive action taken by the US government in view of elections coming forward, and because at the end of the day, it is very clear, as notified through books, as notified through official documents, it's very clear that the Jewish lobby has a great, or Israeli lobby rather, has a very great influence and dominance in American politics and the US Congress. Therefore, you have the Abraham Accords, primarily meant for Bahrain, the UAE, Morocco, Sudan, these countries primarily which were earlier against the state of Israel because of the policies, but now we're willing to normalize ties to recognize the state of Israel and its boundaries for the sake of another mutual benefit. Now, for example, Bahrain was given multiple American contacts, military agreements, etc., etc. UAE, the exact same thing. And Morocco was given the US recognized the Western Sahara as Moroccan territory. We've covered this before in the previous episode as to what the Western Sahara dispute is. If you want any further explanation of the dispute as a whole, we can do that as well. Now, primarily Sudan. Even for Sudan, which earlier was again against the Israeli state, the US decided to remove Sudan from the list of state-sponsored terrorism. That basically opens Sudan up to economic investments, it frees sanctions, etc., etc. Therefore, you have this very a massive diplomatic, so to speak, maneuver by the Americans in order to ensure the Arab states recognize Israel. There were a lot of reports speaking about a possibility of normalization of ties between Saudi Arabia and Israel. That would be a massive thing because Saudi Arabia being one of the dominant leaders in the Arab League, normalizing relations with Israel would make it completely legitimate for Israel to carry out its actions while the Arab League continues to remain silent. That's the perception, at least, from what I can understand. Now, in the Trump administration, and also in addition to all this, had earlier recognized Jerusalem as the Israeli capital. This was obviously seen as a massive violation of international law, plus the idea of complete removal of the U.S. as a mediator, because the U.S. earlier, by the Oslo Accords, had declared neutrality, that there was the need for a two-state solution, and that there was a need for Israel to defend itself, the balancing act, so to speak. When the Trump administration had recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, that moment, that neutrality went away. And this is why, and see again, Jerusalem is a massive religious conflict regarding this. But then, let's put it very simply, the Palestinian Arabs and the Jews view the various sites in Jerusalem as religious sites to their respective religions. And this has caused conflict because the IDF and the Israeli forces have tried to suppress the Arabs whenever they tried to give their prayers, whenever they've gone to perform their rites. And this has caused clashes. This has caused the main heart of the conflict. And this is what ultimately in 2021 results in the Hamas offensive against Israel, which obviously gets thwarted later by negotiations to a third party. But ultimately, it was because of what happened in Sheikh Jarrah and all the religious sites and the border and the various police clashes with the Palestinians that results in Hamas taking offensive action. All right. So the idea of security of the Israeli state against the other Arabs by somehow attacking Palestine and therefore occupying the entirety of it, there is no ground to it. Rather, because of the carpet bombing, because of the relentless blockade on aid, on any kinds of important materials required by the Palestinian people, you have this increasing amount of, well, let's put it, resistance towards the Israeli state. Primarily because the Palestinians understand one thing, the Israeli state is out to destroy the Palestinians in that kind of a sense. That is the meaning you derive when the Israeli government bombs Palestinian targets, which are also civilian. Now, obviously, there is proof to a certain extent to corroborate the idea that yes, indeed, it is the Hamas are also using hospitals and schools in order to launch attacks. But at the same time, there is something in self-defense, which is called the law of proportionality, law of distinction. The law of distinction says that you need to differentiate between a civilian target and a military target. No matter how it is being used, you need to understand when you're killing a civilian, when you're killing a soldier, an opponent army, or a militia group. In the same way, you know, the same actually law, the law of proportionality states that yes, you've been attacked. You have every right to defend yourself the way you feel necessary. But that necessary is determined by an equal and proportionate response. For example, let's put it in a very simplistic way. Say there have been multiple rocket attacks in your territory, okay, that has hit your military targets. You are to ensure the military targets of the other side only are damaged, and that too by the same response or rocket attacks. Just because they've used rockets does not mean you can use a nuclear bomb. That's what basically proportionality very simplistically means. Again, legal interpretations have a lot of different understandings, but this is a very simplistic understanding of it. And oh, by the way, about nuclear bomb, you see, the thing is, as much as the Israeli state is concerned about an Iranian nuclear weapon, there is a lot of proof, obviously disputed, but that the Israeli government itself possesses nuclear weapons. Secretive, covert, but they do possess nuclear weapons. So ultimately, the question is simple. If indeed the Israelis do possess a nuclear weapon, achieving nuclear power parity with the Iranian government would not be a problem, but rather in a way in order to ensure a relaxation of tensions. Now, obviously, this is another major thing to be debated, which can be debated later. But the thing is, again, when you talk about the Israeli security umbrella, the nuclear weapon gives Israel security it requires against its enemies, right? Let's talk about even the territories Israel has captured. The Arab League has been very clear. We want Israel, the state of Israel, to exist, but under the borders that were there before the Six-Day War in 1967, which resulted in territory from Egypt, the Golan Heights in Syria, and these various territories being captured by the Israeli government. And there you go. Therein lies the very provision of what is the need of the hour, and that is the need for the Israeli government to simply comply with what the UN has been saying for the past so many years. Therefore, the idea that there is a need to secure Israel against the entire Arab world, which seems to be antagonistic, there's a reason they are being antagonistic. Security calculations cannot be based on, you know, one-sided thinking that, oh my God, I am doing the right thing, they are doing the wrong thing. If there is a reason against it, it is because of a credible reason. Again, when we talk about realism and offensive realism, we primarily speak about the idea that every state is rational, even if it's North Korea, but every state is rational. And they think in that way, and that's how they pursue their interests. All right, let's now cut to the chase. Ultimately, coming to 2023 offensive, all right? Now that Hamas has attacked Israel, there has obviously been a massive response from the Israeli government in terms of diplomatic maneuvers, military to a scale wider than one could have possibly imagined. The Hezbollah has somewhat stepped in because of the attacks against Israel, because Israel was bombing Lebanon, and which is again the Hezbollah stronghold. Another very important part of this entire conflict is the UN Relief Agency working in Palestine, the UNRWA. Now, reports came out that several UNRWA officials were apparently responsible for collaborating with Hamas members in the 7th October attack. Now, see, these are a few members, low-level officials. That's how the agency puts it. And when you have such a situation, obviously, the one thing that comes into your mind is, well, I mean, how could this happen? A UN should be a neutral agency, etc., etc. Again, you're talking about low-level employees. The institution itself is not supporting the Hamas. I mean, otherwise, you would find the Secretary General or even the chief of the UNRWA talk about supporting Hamas. That's not the case. And because of this one problematic reports come out about a few officials at the low level, we now have the US and its Western allies cutting aid to UNRWA. Now, again, as much as people call the UN useless, the UN aid agency, like the UNRWA and the UNOCHA and others, have played a vital role towards delivering humanitarian aid in some form or some way. And because of the cutting of funds to the UNRWA, they are unable to now send humanitarian aid to different parts of Gaza. Moreover, more importantly, the UNSC today is being used as a means of blocking all forms of humanitarian aid because the Americans aren't allowing it to happen. The Americans don't want a ceasefire at all, and the Americans aren't pressurizing the Israeli government at all. See, contrary to what people are hearing from the US State Department, Politico and other newspapers have been reporting very clearly that internally, the US State Department does not really care, even if the IDF moves into Rafah and captures the territory and bombards civilians. Because, let me explain, this is what we call American security implications. Now, the US believes that the US State Department as a whole is under the idea that by having a proxy state in the form of Israel in the Middle East, they can check Iran, they can check Iraq, they can check the other hostile states. I mean, even Saudi Arabia has been a very key part of this US strategy. And the Americans believe that by supporting Israel against the Palestinians, they will be able to ensure American stronghold over the Middle East, which is completely mistaken. Because let's explain this very, like, bluntly. The more you suppress a people, the more violent they get. Because think of it in this way, right? This is very clear in context throughout histories, cultures, understandings, be it the way in which the various communist revolutions came up in different parts of the world, you know, the way in which revolutions as democratic reforms have come in different parts of the world. The very common theme is that we want power, you will suppress us, we will be angrier, and we will ultimately rise up against you. That's the problem. The more you bombard a population, the more you attack people, you do not... The usual idea is the more we kill them, the better it is. The less people are there to attack us. No. There's something called will and resolve. In a conflict which involves a clear suppression of rights, a clear suppression of aid, of basic things that people need, you will always have that resolve in the people to go up against the oppressor. Remember one thing. You're talking about religions which have spoken about the need to protect their religion against others at the end of the day. And that is how every cultural entity has survived. Which is why today you find the Palestinians supporting Hamas in a mass movement sort of way. You cannot judge them. You cannot blame them for what they're doing today. Because the PLO has been unable to do anything in the UN. The UN has politically failed to achieve anything primarily because of the Americans. And the UN only has been able, and the little the UN was achieving through aid, even that is coming to a dwindling end. That is why you have immense support for Hamas, immense support for violence and extremism throughout the Gaza Strip. Do the Palestinians want peace? Obviously they do. But let's now talk about what the Israelis have been doing, which is causing even more trouble, the settlements. Settlements, think of it in this way, right? You're living in your home, right? You've got a land, owned it. Some person from outside comes and takes it away. And you can't do anything about it because the police and the others are from their country. And they are oppressing you. And they're taking you to go out. They throw you out. That is what is happening in the Gaza. Again, very simplistically put. But yes, that's what's happening. Because you have settlers from Israel moving into different territories in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank, taking over territory, and nothing has been done. Because the problem is, the way in which the Six-Day War went, the Yom Kippur War went, you have basically the Gaza Strip in one end towards the west and the West Bank towards the east, somewhat, if you think about it that way. Northeast, so to speak. And they're separated by miles and miles of territory. And ultimately, they are divided into different like walls, structures, problems, and issues. Some of these walls, by the way, are completely illegal by international law, by the way. The ICJ itself has proclaimed it. And see, the IDF primarily is, behind this is that it divides Palestinians. It's a clear divide and rule strategy. I mean, my Indian brothers would obviously understand, because divide and rule means that you can divide the people and prevent them from organizing. Unfortunately, it has completely failed because they've organized on a massive scale two intifadas. They've worked with the Hamas and the PIJ and other organizations, and they've launched attacks which are credibly very hostile right now. As for the hostage situation, ultimately there was a complete failure in the Israeli state to act, and it could be seen from the Hamas as an act of terror. as an act of terror. You cannot, again, one more thing, the idea of a terrorist organization is clearly portrayed out in the UN resolutions. And what Hamas has done may be regarded as acts of terror, but you cannot simply brand it a terror organization. It would not be what it is. It is an extremist organization, it's a radical organization, but it is not a terrorist organization in that sense, legally speaking. Again, we can obviously explain this in detail later, but a primary thing is that because of the settlements have increased ever since the Six-Day War ended, you have this antagonistic Palestinian population which wants to rise against the Israelis because they are being evicted from their homes. They are being unable to be to be in the land which is their own. And therefore, and the Israeli government under Netanyahu has pursued a massive policy of expansion of settlements. Even in 2014, the UNSC declared that these settlements are illegal and the US abstained, quite interestingly. Obviously, ever since then, the Trump administration has made sure that it is the first time, but let's put it this way. The Trump administration, during his tenure, Trump had asked his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to basically introduce a new plan for the Palestinian peace process. Now, the main plan was, fair enough, you have Palestine, this is comprising of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, which connects the two territories to a 1,000-mile tunnel, all right? And the walls continue to be there, the settlements continue to be as they are, only Israel won't build any further settlements in the next 4 years. And there'd be mass economic investment, etc., etc. Again, one more thing. When you're looking at a revolution, when you're looking at an armed, violent movement by a people who are proud of their culture and religion, you cannot in any way buy them off. Let's draw parallels to the French Revolution, all right, or Russian Revolution, so to speak, right? These are people who had valid concerns. These are people who wanted reforms, and because of that, no amount of money could buy them out, no amount of suppression could destroy them, and ultimately they became successful in their own ways. And as to what happened later is a different thing, but these are the main causes and factors, right? And the same thing applies here as well. You have a people fighting for their own land, their own rights, their own people, their religion, their culture, and which is why, again, you have this conflict and you can't buy them off. It's simple as that. Okay, let's now review two of the most let's look at the two most important solutions which have been portrayed so far. First is a very prevalent two-state solution. Now, from what I can understand of it, it basically means you have Israel, which withdraws territory till the 1967 borders, like how it was before the Six-Day War, and Palestine formed by the Gaza Strip and the West Bank and some kind of infrastructure to connect the two territories, so to speak. Primarily, that is a two-state solution because that ensures a peaceful process, etc., etc. However, unfortunately, because settlements, the Israeli invasion of the Gaza Strip, etc., etc., you cannot have a two-state solution in reality. A one-state solution, or as to how I have amended it in my understanding of what it has become over the various years, the one-state solution obviously in the beginning was only Israel existing. But over time, it has become basically a greater Israel, like the entirety of that territory being a greater Israel, but a Palestinian region which has a high level or degree of autonomy in terms of local administration, local issues, but foreign affairs, defense, etc., are all handled by the Israeli state. So Palestinians as a state don't exist. As a part of a state, they do. Now, both proposals are equally not the best to go forward, right? Therefore, obviously today, what we find the idea primarily, what I would think is better is the one which was earlier developed by Morrison and Grady in their plan and trying to incorporate those parts while incorporating the other solution. For example, the Morrison and Grady plan basically meant you have the Jewish territories, you have the Palestinian territories, all right? Now what we do is we ensure that the territories Israel has are those which existed till the Six-Day War began and ended. And the Palestinian territories are those which primarily and those Palestinian territories are these dogs are having a big, big rush today. But the Palestinian territories primarily, again, those territories are reunited in a different way, in economic infrastructure, so to speak. But the capital, Jerusalem, disputed capital, remains under either a neutral body which is governing it or under the UN, and it is to be internationalized. Because Jerusalem is the heart of this dispute. And the problem is they are both religions have equally correct, equally disputed claims. And that's what is the stoke of the issue, which is why we require either the internationalization of Jerusalem or a neutral body governing it like the UN in all probability. Ultimately, see, the idea of an Israeli state and a Palestinian state, both are equally important and equally to be respected. Which is why the UN, unfortunately, has been unable to come to any direct action, primarily because the US, while speaking about a two-state solution, continues to support Israel in its own war against the Palestinians and Hamas. As to how the war will go forward from here is anyone's idea of thinking, because Rafah is currently, it could be on the verge of, it's on the verge of a siege, because the IDF has slowly amassed its troops around that territory at this point. The Americans, while publicly there have been warnings, there have been constant bickerings about, yes, the Israeli government cannot be violating international law, it cannot invade. Internally, it is very clear that the American State Department believes that, well, Israel should go about Rafah as they see fit and then go ahead. And per the US security understanding of their State Department, they're right in that sense. Humanitarian aid is not being able to reach Gaza because of the UN Security Council deadlock, because of the UNRWA fundings being cut. And again, because different alternatives, it takes time to build these lines, right? And at the end of the day, when the Israelis aren't themselves providing access, how can you possibly get humanitarian aid in? The situation is grave. It has ramifications which will go throughout this entire region. You have Saudi Arabia and the others probably at this point having second thoughts about the relationship with Israel. Even for that fact, different countries signed the Abraham Accords are not really happy with what's happening with the Israel-Hamas conflict. You even have Turkey and others who are clearly against the state of Israel. You have Iran, which has activated its proxies, and Hezbollah, Hamas, the PIJ, all of which are now vehemently going after Israel. And remember one thing, if the Hezbollah begins a massive offensive against the state of Israel, that's when the problem starts, because Israel can't handle a two-front war, especially among two guerrilla insurgent groups. Guerrilla means they're basically through harsh terrain, these forces are able to camouflage and are known to terrain. Therefore, they can work in those areas and therefore get a much greater advantage than regular troops or regular army would usually have, you know. This is why guerrilla warfare has actually been able to gain much more success than conventional warfare. Which is why today it's very dominant in the entire world. And obviously there's a threat of terrorism which obviously lies, because Al-Qaeda and ISIS could always use this opportunity to keep on speaking about the Palestinian cause. Because again, the idea is extremist organizations require one issue. And one issue, if they can drive that home, that's how they get support. That's how they've been able to flourish for so many years. Whatever happens from now on obviously requires the UN to take action. But really, I mean, this reason why probably sound repetitive so to this extent is because you can't really say anything about this. You can't really say, in what will you say? It's wrong, it's bad, it's... Because at the end of it, it's not about right or wrong. It's about a distorted understanding of what security really means. I completely agree. Israel has a right to this self-defense. The Israelis should defend themselves. You have to think about the people of Israel who were that day abducted by Hamas militants, whose homes were taken away by Hamas. But then also you think about the Palestinians whose homes were taken away by the Israelis. At the end of it, it's a conflict with two opposing ends, clearly polarized. And a common ground is the only way to go forward. Let's be blunt. So the problem is, look, at the end of every podcast or at the end of every serious issue, you want to come to a happy point or like a satisfaction. Okay, fine, let's just hope this happens, you know. Problem is, in circumstances like these, you can't just hope. You can't just say that, well, I mean, this is going to turn out this way, because the clear thing is the security dimensions. Again, these are very distorted, because if you think about it in an actual balance of equation, power, etc., these aren't this, because Israel is bombarding the Gaza Strip even further and further. You have the Hamas becoming more and more violent, people turning towards them, and it's a cycle in that way. Ugly cycle. Frankly, thinking about it from that perspective, the Oslo Accords really were the beginning of a new change. Even the Abraham Accords, I mean, they would provide Israel a guarantee. And the nuclear weapon Israel holds, I mean, that's another guarantee in that sense. Honestly, at this point, if you just think about it, either it's external pressure or it is American pressure which will prevent it from happening. But then again, putting it very bluntly, it won't happen. At the end of it, the only hope is that ultimately the SC is able to overcome deadlock and ensure that humanitarian aid reaches the people of Gaza, and we support the idea of peace for as long as we can. Even if, let's forget the idea of a solution and let's just come to ceasefire, which obviously, again, is highly unlikely. Thank you for listening in. Honestly, I know it's been 2 years since all this happened, all this began. I think ever since then, it's the podcast community has grown to leaps and bounds. These issues, the reason why we started this podcast is because, see, issues like these are very complex. They're very difficult to understand, right? I try my best efforts in a certain way to ensure that all of you understand it in a better, simpler way. Because, see, at the end of it, politics as a whole is not a one-sided thing. There are always two sides, three sides to the argument. It's like a coin. And it's a very complex instrument which will keep on changing sides. There's no right or wrong in politics. There's just a side. And that's all there is. Which is why my mission is to at least realistically explain what is what and what is not in that sense. Again, like, what the world is, not what the world should be. And I hope you enjoy I hope you've understood and learned. Like, I mean, it's nothing to enjoy because of the current situation, but I hope we've learned a bit. I mean, obviously, this is not going to do justice to the entire issue and conflict. I've really miniaturized a lot of different aspects of this. I simply hope you've understood this in a far better way, in a comprehensive way, in a way which is unbiased and at least in a certain way helps you get both the sides in a proper understanding and how distorted both versions are. And yeah, and very soon we'll be releasing episodes on the issue of the US and Russia. There's a completely another fiasco going there. Yeah, nuclear war. Can you imagine how amazing? We'll talk about that as well. The Houthi angle in this entire conflict is because the Houthis very interestingly supported the Hamas, and interestingly, they've launched an offensive in the Red Sea. We'll speak about the Houthi angle here, as well as the US-Russia tensions, so to speak. And and obviously keep listening to the podcast, share it with your friends and family, give us all the opinion and feedback you possibly can think of. I'll give my email in the description. Have a look at it. Follow us on Spotify or any other platform you're on. And please give us all the support you can. And yes, I promise you, I'll make sure the episodes come out now properly and regularly. Thank you very much. Aryan Ghosh, sign off.